This broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in downtown Urbana. November 19th through December 17th, the Holiday Market will be open Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. inside Lincoln Square Village with produce, plants, baked goods, arts, crafts, and more. Information at 344-3872 or online at urbanabusiness.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Yankee Doodle, Jack Sprat, Georgie Porgy. What are the origins of these nursery rhymes? Many rhymes were born of religious and political strife. Many contain violent references and, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, sexual innuendo. I believe many of us have suspected that nursery rhymes have backstories, if you will. But what are they? On the program today, we're going to take a look at the meanings of nursery rhymes, past and present. Our guest is Chris Roberts. He is the author of Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. Chris Roberts is a librarian and the proprietor of South London's F&M Walking Tours. His book, Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown, began as a self-published project in Britain. It's now available in the U.S. from Gotham Books. Chris Roberts, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Celeste.
Oh, nice to talk with you. This project grew out of your walking business. Would you tell us the story?
I started looking into, well, the East of London Bridge, really, was the beginning point. Sometimes when you get children on the tours, it was a good idea to throw in something that they might relate to. So I gave them the origin of London Bridges Falling Down, which was a Norwegian poem originally, about a man called King Olaf who towed away a wooden London bridge by attaching his ships to it, waiting for the tide and then pulling it down. And the original one goes, London Bridge is broken down, gold is won and bright renown, shield resounding, war horse sounding, Hilda shouting in the din. Hilda is one of those Norse gods that kind of fell out of favor when Christianity came around. But it sort of mutated over the centuries to be a celebration of the famous stone London Bridge that stood for 600 years. And that was very much on my walking tour beat, and I found several others. We have a rhyme, London's Burning, and the Monument to the Fire of London is very near London Bridge as well. So I just started adding these to my regular tours, and over time, I got interested in other nursery rhymes, ones that aren't London-based, if you like, more general ones, deviated off down there. So that's really how it all started.
Yeah. How is it that these rhymes that so often deal with, tough topics, death, cruelty, sex, how is it that they came to be nursery rhymes?
Some of them were deliberately written for children. I was giving information, even if it was harsh information. There's some terrible ones about warning children not to wet their bed. There's ones about an incident 400 years ago where a religious minority, an extreme fringe of religious minority, tried to blow up Parliament. It's called Remember, Remember the 5th of November. So those ones are telling stories that are still understandable today. What happened with some of the more, if you like, codified ones, things like Little Jack Horner, was that the meaning got scrambled as they were written up as collections towards the, certainly in the 18th century, but and again in the 19th century, and they began to be illustrated for children, and the covert meaning was lost, and the illustration went for a kind of direct interpretation. So you have a picture of Little Jack Horner sitting in a corner eating his Christmas pie, and you have a picture of a man with the pie, And yet what it's actually about is the acquisition of some property during the reign of Henry VIII, and the coded meaning's gone, but the image of the man with the pie remains. So they crossed over, some of them, from an adult side to children's side as they were written up.
Yeah. Well,
that
your book, Little Jack Horner, is where you begin with the rhymes themselves. And I would say that this rhyme tells the story of a white collar theft, if you will. and also, apparently, Little Jack Horner was the man who was this rhyme was based on was also quite the climber, upgrading wives every few years.
Oh no, that was the man who gave him the property who did that. But he was, it's a very good description. I wish I'd thought of that, the white collar crime. Essentially, what his name was actually Thomas Horner. What happened to him was he was asked to deliver some properties to King Henry VIII, who's the man who liked to upgrade his wives. And in one version, Thomas Horner steals the one set of title deeds to a place called Mell's Manor. A more likely interpretation is that when he delivered the deeds to Henry VIII, the king gave him or sold him the Mell's Manor very, very cheaply, and it was a means for the king to raise money. It was also a means to establish political support for what the king was doing. So these were up-and-coming Protestant gentry who were taking advantage of the fact that land was being taken from the Catholic Church. So it's a very modern tale of gentrification,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Sorry about that. I got my characters royally screwed up there.
Which is pretty much what Henry did most of the time.
Yeah. Now it's interesting that Thomas Horner's descendants have another take on the story. They say their ancestor paid fair and square.
Yeah, they would say that. And I think he paid for it, but I think he paid a very small amount for it, just on the research. They, last time anybody checked, they were still living there. This is, nearly 400 years on. His descendants still live in Mell's Manor, apparently. So it's a very lovely property. So they've hung on to it and kept it there. But that's the sort of thing that happens with the rhymes, that the rhyme would originally have been a Catholic rhyme criticizing the Protestant ascendancy in England. And a lot of these rhymes do seem to go back to a 200-year period where there's scrapping between Protestants and Catholics as to who should be king, who should be running the country. And many of them seem to be born from that. And because people were less free to say what they like at that time, some of them were written in a slight code.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Sing a Song of Sixpence then.
Oh, we're back to, that's Henry VIII as well.
Yeah.
It's actually the same, it's alluding to the same incident, although the end bit's quite interesting with the two, well, one's out, one of his wives, Catherine of Aragon, is out in the parlour, and the other one, his second wife, Anne Boleyn, is represented as the maid, who gets her nose snipped off by blackbirds when in real life, of course, she was executed by a specially brought in French executioner who specialized in executing women, apparently, which is an odd career choice to have, but nevertheless, that was I can't imagine asking for that at the job center today, but in those days they were in much demand.
Now, who would have recited such a rhyme at the time?
They would have been adults primarily, and some of them start like, as if you like, tavern songs. But there's another thing to bear in mind, which is this division that we have today, and has been going on for nearly 200 years now, of children's entertainment and adult entertainment, is not really established. 300 or 400 years ago, that children, you couldn't really shield children from adult sights, and children were very much regarded as young adults.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that classic Dickensian thing of sending little boys up chimneys at very early ages. Children would go out to work and earn their money, so they would be almost treated like little adults. So this idea that they would have separate songs for themselves doesn't really come about until nearly 200 years ago, where you get this division of childhood, if you like, and adulthood. The idea comes in that they're split off.
Yeah.
So in answer to your question, sorry, it's a roundabout way of saying anybody would have sung them, I think. It's probably a fair response.
Yeah. Well, would these rhymes in some sense been equivalent to our Daily Show in the U.S.? I mean, a way for people to communicate with one another quickly and humorously and with some digs.
Certainly. I mean, because we've got so many mediums today. We have radio and TV and the internet, and these would be very much social commentary. If I may add a slightly risque one in, I know it's lunchtime with you, but rub-a-dub-dub, three men in a tub, and who do you think were there? The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and all jumped out of a rotten potato. It was enough to make a man stare. This is a slightly, although it's a slightly strange version, it's actually a bolderized version of an earlier rhyme that went, rub-a-dub-dub, three maids in a tub, and who do you think were there? The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and all of them gone to the fair. And this is classic. I mean, I could have picked up a newspaper today at my local newsstand that would have a tale of respectable people caught out at a lap dancing club, and that essentially is what this rhyme's about. It's about these bourgeois tradesfolk at a sideshow, at a fair sideshow, ogling some naked young ladies. That's the basis of rub-a-dub-dub. So, yes, they would very much convey information, whether satirical or more pointed. That was definitely one of their functions.
Kind of like a verbal graffiti.
Yes, is the way. It would hand down through generations. There would be local variants on these things as well, which is why you get many different versions of some of them. Tying it into a local character rather than a national one, if you like. They have long longevity on their side.
Yeah. So they often morphed.
Yeah, very much. I mean, you alluded to Yankee Doodle earlier on, mm-hmm. and there's I could have written a whole book on Yankee Doodle. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of versions, either written by the Americans or Canadians or British, often conflicting with each other. But it was essentially a popular dance tune. It's a bit like somebody in Chicago comes up with a new kind of dance music. Very swiftly, somebody in Manchester nicks the tune and reworks it and redoes the lyrics and then sends it back to Chicago, and you get this kind of back and forth. Yankee Doodle's a good early example of that. And it was, in fact, a dance tune originally. There's a lovely variant that goes, Yankee Doodle, keep it up, Yankee Doodle dandy, mind the music and the step, and with the girls be handy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder that there were slightly different dance steps in the US and Europe at the time, so the chap better be a bit careful with the lady in case he treads on her toes. It's just a slight warning. So but it's a nice one, Yankee Doodle. I like the fact that the Americans turned it on the British, even though it was originally a British song. It's a nice bit of irony and comic timing. They played it at Bunker Hill. It's good. But the original, the most popular surviving lyric, that Yankee Doodle comes to town riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap, called it macaroni, was a British version, alluding to a youth group called the Macaronis, who were kind of like New Romantics, if you can remember those from the 1980s, very, very dandified young men about London who spent hours getting ready. And the essence of the rhyme is that it takes more than putting a feather in your cap to become a macaroni. It takes a lot harder to achieve the look, if you like. So that's two of the versions.
Now today, if I was with you in London and we went out on the street and we asked somebody to recite Yankee Doodle, would it be the same Yankee Doodle that we recite here in the U.S.?
What's the version that you do?
It was the one that you gave us. Yankee Doodle came to town riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap, and called it macaroni. And then also there's the dance. That's what I also recall.
We don't have the dance. How does the step go?
I don't know.
This is radio,
well,
isn't it?
It's not so much I know what the dance is, but it is, you know, be nimble, which reminds me of another nursery rhyme.
This is Jack. In answer to your question, yes, people would. That is the version that we know here. That is the most popular one that we know. Because there's somewhere there are slight variations between collections that were printed in America and collections that were printed here, but no, that one's the same. And it's, you were going to be nimble, weren't you? You were going to jump across. Jack be nimble, Jack be quick. Jack jumped over a candlestick. It's a really lovely story. It's about fortune telling. It's going back to pagan fire jumping, and the idea is that if you can jump over a candle. Some people, they practice it on New Year, and some places, Buckinghamshire, I think it's November the 25th, and St. Catherine, the patron saint of weave makers. Anyway, they jumped over it, and the idea was that if you could jump over the candle without putting out the flame, that was a good thing. That was a positive thing for the New Year. I suggest in the book that it's just to do with weight loss and fitness, and if you have the ability and strength to jump over the candle without putting out the flame, then you're probably quite fit and you'll probably be working for the next year quite safely. But that could just be me misinterpreting it. But the essence of it is as a means of telling the future.
Yeah. Well, what challenges did researching these rhymes pose for you?
Massive, because there's been some very good academic work on nursery rhymes, which I've drawn on. There's also been an incredible amount of, if you like, urban legend making about them. The English Satanist Aleister Crowley wrote a book, I think it's 1898, on the occult meanings of nursery rhymes. And about 5 years later, he announced to the world that this was a hoax. It was a very clever hoax, but nevertheless, it was a hoax. And, of course, all those theories are out there, and they have to be disproved. They have to be knocked down. So that was some of the things. And I would find stories that I would really love to have put in the book that are just patently not true, which is a real shame because they were, at one time I was going to have an appendix at the back of, if you like, incorrect stories because they were amusing, but I have run out of space to do it. So that was a big problem.
Next edition, maybe, huh?
Yes.
Well, it's a lovely book. I would think it's going to do or is doing very well.
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's funny having the American edition with the glossary in the back. I think that there are perhaps too many terms in there. I think most Americans would understand that we call the tube the we call the subway the tube, but
we call the tube the television. So not only are there differences, but they can be wildly different. But the glossary is great fun.
I think some of them are very good. I had real trouble translating the English term "copping off with," which means when you meet somebody and you're not quite in relationship with them, but you're not maybe at first base. I think might be the American equivalent. It's a very English term, but some of the words are very particular to where I live now in Southeast London. The word "sort" for babe, I think, is unique to Southeast London, and the word "woollybach" is unique to Liverpool, which is where I'm from, to describe people who are from the suburbs, from outside of the city. So I think some explanation was necessary. But,
have to call in the language boffins.
Yes.
Now explain what a boffin is.
A boffin is, I think you use the term egghead. It's somebody who's a bit too much of an expert on something that nobody else is really interested in. Somebody who's obsessed with the design of windows on double-decker buses, for example, might be described as a boffin. to pick a recent example here. They're phasing out the double-decker buses in London, for those who don't know. It's a real shame.
Yeah.
Loss. That's no nursery rhymes about that. That's a bit too modern.
Oh. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Chris Roberts. He's the author of Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments about nursery rhymes for our guest, Chris Roberts. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Chris Roberts is a librarian, and he is the proprietor of South London's F&M Walking Tours. And you can find him online at fnmpublications.co.uk. And if you don't have a pencil at the moment, well, you can join us on our website, and there's a link to Chris Roberts there on our site as well. I want to go back to the question of, you know, who was reciting these rhymes at the time. And I want to follow up with this question. Were the subjects of these rhymes, you know, it could be the king, it could be the church, very powerful institutions. Were the subjects of these rhymes aware of them?
The people reciting rhymes would hope not, but
right.
In the incident, if they were challenged, they would just say, "Well, no, this is a rhyme. I've got Jack, thinking of Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean." Now, allegedly, that's about King Charles I of England, but if the king's men challenged anybody singing that, they would say, "No, it's about a man called Jack Sprat. Of course, it's about a man called Jack Sprat and his wife." And so they would be, I don't think anybody was executed for reciting nursery rhymes, if you like, even though some of them are, some of them talk about people being executed for different, for three blind mice as an association with owning the Bible in English, which became a crime during the time of Mary Tudor. So although they might allude to people being punished, there's no record of anybody actually being punished for reading nursery rhymes. Although, interestingly, in England in the 70s, I say early 80s, some local authorities tried to ban Bar Bar Black Sheep on the grounds that it might promote racial prejudice, which is strange because it's actually about taxation. But that's a complete deviation of the subject of punishment. So people wouldn't... I don't think anyone was punished for these rhymes because they were. There's no authorship to them. They're anonymous. They're folk songs, if you like, telling little stories or telling how life is. And it would be very hard to find the original person who wrote them.
Yeah.
Like, so.
Yeah, we're back to that idea of graffiti.
We are, yes. Yeah. It's anonymous. Although some graffiti people like to. Like to make it clear that they've done it, but this is all pre-copyright, which is probably why nursery rhymes in the future will be very different, because there aren't many avenues of copyright-free song out there. We have football chants in the soccer chants, rather, in England. I'm not sure of the American equivalent, perhaps some songs that are sung in playgrounds, children's games, whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't think... People are very keen to claim credit for their work now. So if somebody was writing a collection of nursery rhymes, they'd probably say, "This is my collection of nursery rhymes," which doesn't work in quite the same way.
Yeah. On playgrounds in the U.S. and in parks where children skip rope, there are lots of rhymes.
That's right, yeah. It's sort of rhyming games. So if some of those survive into the future... Or even, I mean, strange things like advertising jingles. If a company goes, the company ceases to exist, but the jingle is remembered, that's another odd route in the future. But I don't know where they're going to come from. But in the past, they were just anonymously written things sung, not even written down necessarily, but sung and passed through the community.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting for us in Chicago on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm enjoying the show. Can you comment, Chris, on Jack and Jill? Was that an actual torture, or was that adultery? Or I'd heard several different things.
I hadn't heard of the torture one, but the adultery thing you're nearer the mark on. There's two associations here. One is with a Norse legend, a Scandinavian legend about a young couple going up to the top of the hill on May Day to collect dew for the fertility ritual the next day for the dancing around the maypole. And from a psychological reading of nursery rhymes, a book called Cradle Will Fall. Is the association that It's actually a warning about premarital sex. It's a warning about this young couple going up to the top of the hill, the falling down and breaking crown, suggesting loss of virginity. And interestingly, there's an extra verse that isn't often in it, with Jill coming down and laughing at what's happened to Jack, and Jill being punished by her mother. So that's the association I have in the book from, I'll say, from the psychological reading of Nursery Rhymes and from Norse legend. So torture implements, no, but sexual practice, yes.
Wow. Yeah. I've got another question about Ring Around the Rosie. I heard that was to do with the plague.
I have to, in the book, what I did was, if a rhyme exists around the time of what it's supposed to be talking about, so Jack Sprat and Charles I, there's a strong possibility that it's about that. The problem with Ring Around the Roses, which is that the rhyme doesn't come about until quite some time after the last plague outbreak in Europe, but the idea of plague is so hardwired into the European consciousness, I think in a way that it isn't in America, because there was never the devastation, that you can't prove that it isn't about the Black Death. But I should tell you the alternative theory, which is that it's a means, and this is a popular explanation in America and also some parts of England, that it's a means of getting round a ban on dancing by the Puritan church authorities. It's by making the rhyme a children's rhyme and having a little dance with it. It allowed children at least to dance, whereas the church authorities in strict Puritan communities wouldn't allow adults to. So that's the that's the unsinister side of it, if you like. But I can't prove that one either way, and I really, it's the only one in the whole book that I leave hanging, that I leave absolutely, because so many people believe it's about the Black Death. It's the one that everybody knows, and I think that's for a reason. I think there's something deep in our psyche that...
very interesting. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited. You can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Chris Roberts, author of Heavy Words, Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. In Ring a Ring o' Roses, which we know here in the U.S. is Ring Around the Rosies, something like that, I think.
Yeah,
it's a little different, but it was also interesting to learn that there are regional English versions of the rhyme that suggest the falling down is more of a curtsy.
Yeah, it was as part of the dance step. That would be a part of it. So it's a dropping down onto your knee, if you like, or if you're a gentleman, or curtsying if you're a young lady. So there are these associations with innocent dance, as well as the more macabre one with the Black Death. But it does have several different slight variations. There's, the most popular one is Pocket Ring of the Roses, Pocket Full of Posies, a tissue, we all fall down. There is a version that runs Ashes, we all fall down. So many of these were rewritten and over the centuries and actually picked up different meanings through time. Grand Old Duke of York was originally the brave old King of France, had 40,000 men marching up the top of the hill. And a journalist in 1820, took that rhyme and then changed it to the Grand Old Duke of York and used it as a means of satirizing the Duke of York at the time, who'd been a bit ineffective in fighting in Flanders in northeast Europe. So, northwest Europe. So there are these rhymes that have a meaning, and they pick up different ones as they go through their life. Humpty Dumpty being a prime example of that.
Now, what's that rhyme?
Well, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall.
Humpty Dumpty
had a great fall. all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. The origin, the real origin, seems to be a warning about behavior, about there are some actions that you take and you must live with the consequences. You must be careful how you behave, because the consequences will not be something you can fix again, hence the metaphor of the egg smashing, which are really tricky to do if you've ever tried to pull them back together again. And then it kind of moves. It's by the 14th century. It's an ale and brandy-based drink, or later on it comes to describe a clumsy person of either sex. So this phrase, Humpty Dumpty, is in the language. And there's an odd association. During our Civil War, the term Humpty Dumpty came to be a nickname for a cannon on the walls of a city called Colchester. And the cannon was being defended by the king's men during the Civil War. The opposing side managed to knock the cannon off the wall, whereupon it shattered, because their cast iron things are quite brittle. And there you get a perfect bit for the ending of the rhyme, that all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. So you have this rhyme that's moving, if you like, because it's part of the language, it's part of the culture, and different associations get picked up throughout history.
Yeah. When I was reading Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, Rap's lyrics came to mind. You know, they rhyme, and also, unless you're in the know, you might not know what the rapper is rapping about.
Yeah, that's very true. There's a rhyme that goes, I don't know if you know how popular it is in America, Seesaw Marjorie Daw, starts like that, which is normally illustrated as a young lady on a seesaw going up and down, and it's quite a cheerful light rhyme. But until the 18th century, the word door meant slut or slattern. So what you have is a rhyme that actually starts up and down, goes Marjorie the slattern, which completely twists the meaning of the rhyme. Which is the same, because I listen to bands today, and I don't always understand the reference. I understand that there is a reference sometimes, that there's something else being said, but I can't always follow it.
Yeah.
We have the same difficulty with the word goose.
Goosey-goosey gander?
Goosey-goosey gander. Well, just the phrase Mother Goose, which we know in this country, but we don't really apply, because the term goose once meant prostitute here, and that, I think, has rather changed any association with Mother Goose. So a lot of it is just to do with words changing their meaning over the centuries, which happens in our own life. I like the phrase. I think in 50 years' time, there's a phrase that I see in gangster films, to put a cap in someone, meaning to shoot them, which is, in 50 years' time, somebody could look at that and just think, well, no, you don't put a cap in someone. You put a cap on someone. That makes no sense. And they will translate it as to put a cap on someone, which is to congratulate somebody, and the whole meaning of the phrase changes. And this is the sort of thing that's happened with many of the rhymes. One of the most useful books I used in researching this was just the Oxford English Dictionary, I'm looking back at the changing meaning of terms.
Yeah. Well, I think now, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about macaroni and who the macaronis were. I believe there is a rap lyric about, it's kind of, I would guess it would be a rapper describing a contemporary macaroni and describing jewelry in the grill, which is...
Is that mouth? Is that jewelry in the mouth?
Yeah, jewelry.
I know, I'm guessing.
You know, it's like a gem attached to the teeth.
That's fantastic. That's a great phrase. That's a really good phrase.
Yeah, a lot of wonderful creative stuff out there, but you need some. I need some help.
No, I
deciphering
need some
it.
Translation.
I am not in the know.
But it is a very. And it's a good analogy, actually, about music. It's a very good analogy with nursery rhymes, in some ways, because they are talking in code about adult things that isn't immediately accessible to a broader community. And the key difference is, though, I guess what I said before is that they will probably have copyrighted that phrase, unlike the nursery rhyme writers. You know, I think they'd be quite cross if somebody nicked it.
Although it's bound to be sampled somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah. Or, yes. Well, somebody in Manchester is probably doing it now, in fact. It's just, that's what they do.
Just open the window out there.
Yeah.
The rhyme that we, so many of us know, I think you say, we, one that everyone knows, ring a ring of roses, a ring around the rosies, what I learned it as growing up.
Yeah.
The meaning of that, other than the fun of it and the dance of it, was totally lost on me as a kid. I had no idea what it was all about, but it was a fun thing to circle around with one's friends and then crash to the ground. Humpty Dumpty is, you know, you could, as a child, whether it was maybe taking care of your toys or taking care of when you were on your tricycle, it makes sense.
I think with, because one of the things I've spoken to people a lot about this, and one, it's strange how children do respond to them. Like, you're absolutely right, actually. Humpty Dumpty does kind of make sense as a literal rhyme, and some of them do. But what surprised me was that people often are frightened by rhymes that I always thought was completely innocuous. There's one that goes, it's raining, it's pouring, the old man is snoring, he went to bed and bumped his head and didn't get up in the morning, which I thought was just, I don't know, quite a ribald rhyme about just a man having a nice time, slightly hurting himself and taking a day off work. And I spoke to this one gentleman. No, this is really, that was all, like, I didn't think too much about it. But I thought, this one gentleman thought it was terrible that he'd bumped his head and the man had clearly died and was disturbed throughout his childhood by this particular rhyme. So, aside from the, if you like, the obvious meanings that you're encouraged to look at because of the illustration, and the illustrations do play a big part in how these rhymes lost their meaning, and the ones that you can make some sort of sense of, like you said with Humpty Dumpty, that children will often pluck out meanings that are just personal to them, and in some ways quite disturbing, even in the like that one, even the more innocuous ones. So it is strange how they do seem to evoke something.
Yeah. Well, that the
people,
the rhyme about the old man who bumped his head and couldn't get up in the morning, when I was a kid, I just thought that was something like, you know, slapstick. Punch and Judy or the Three Stooges.
That's how I saw it. I just saw it as comic, and I was really disturbed by this.
Oh, my.
Over it now. He's in his 30s by now. He's definitely over it, but he had some difficult years. Very strange. The odd what people pick out of them. And what I've tried to do is I'll say, pick out the better historical stories and put them into a kind of context as well, put them into a modern day context so people can disassociate from their childhood, if you like, and look at them in an adult way. I'm particularly fond of Georgie Porgy, which I think you mentioned earlier, which I wanted to believe so much was about the man called George Villiers, the gay lover of our King James I. And I so wanted it to be about that, but unfortunately, it isn't. It's a much more, in a sense, modern rhyme about it's about childhood obesity. It's almost a government health warning.
You're kidding?
No. It's basically, don't put on too much weight. You'll scare the girls away. It's just that very. The original version is Roly Poly Pudding and Pie, not Georgie Porgy. It's Roly Poly.
That rings a bell from my childhood.
What, the pudding, the pudding,
bit. Yeah, the Roly Poly pudding and pie.
So I was disappointed in that, but at least I could draw some modern parallel from it.
Yeah.
If you like.
Well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Earlier you mentioned that you, in the course of researching these, you ran across a lot of great stories, but they were not true about the origins of these rhymes. Among them, if you had to pick out one that was not true but a great story, what would it be?
I quite like the Georgie Porgie one, but there's one about a pussycat going to London to visit the Queen, and it's quite a long verse, but it's supposed to be about some cat visiting Queen Elizabeth I, which is complete nonsense. The other one I quite like is "Hey diddle diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon, little devil laughed to see such fun, and something ran away with a spoon." And this is from Crowley, the Satanist, who just came up with this whole thing about it being a dog star and to do with blood sacrifices and the Egyptian pantheon of Osiris and whatever. And he concocted this whole theory about the Egyptian gods and the pharaohs linked into this rhyme. I think that's probably the most involved and complex one, and but sadly not true at all. Just something he came up with.
What rhyme posed the greatest difficulty to decipher?
I'd have to go back to "Ring a Ring of Roses" because it's the only one that I leave absolutely. That and "Merry Merry Quite Contrary."
Yeah,
I leave that one. That's kind of undecided as well. Because it can't be proved either way, and I would like "Merry Merry Quite Contrary" to be about Mary Tudor, but I don't. I suspect it probably isn't, but it probably is about gardening, which is slightly disappointing considering all the possibilities there. But "Ring a Ring of Roses" is definitely the hardest to unpick, because in the end you just come up with a blank wall. It's either about children's dancing, or it's about the extermination of a third of the population of Europe, which is quite a thing to bridge,
yeah.
A thing to get across.
"Merry, Merry, Quite Contrary, How Does Your Garden Grow?"
Grow.
With silver bells and cockle shells and pretty maids all in a row.
It's the theory is that the pretty maids all in a row are to do with Mary Queen of Scots and her court and her love of shiny things. And the other theory is about Mary Tudor and the silver bells and cockle shells. There you've got your euphemism for torture implements, and the pretty maids are actually the widowed husbands of people she's had executed. So that's the two theories to do with "Merry, Merry, Quite Contrary." But the rhyme doesn't come into existence until some time later, so it's suspect, unfortunately. And so, do you have a favourite rhyme yourself? Do you?
I would have to go back to "Yankee Doodle."
Yeah, it's a nice one.
Yeah. It's a merry one, and there's something so deliciously rebellious about it. That's why I like it. I wanted to ask you, speaking of Mary, Queen of Scots, and Mary Tudor, are you familiar with the game that kids play in the dark in front of a mirror? Bloody Mary?
Yeah, it's to do, there's a movie called The Candyman that I think plays on this urgent urban legend. You mustn't say "Bloody Mary" in front of the mirror. Is it three times?
Three times.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I don't know the origin of that. I mean, I'm interested in where the drink's named after her. And the we have a card game called "Bloody Mary" as well in this country, which goes by a number of other names. And there does seem to be this kind of going back to this character of Mary as I am. That's a bit of a one, as we say.
It makes you wonder, you know, how many other, you know, what have the spin-offs been for
the Mary franchise?
Yeah.
Did she invest in it? I don't know. Did she own a card factory? If possible?
We have a beverage. We have an urban legend
and a card game
and
potentially, well, definitely a nursery rhyme in Three Blind Mice, and possibly another one with Mary. Mary, she laid down tracks for the future. Now, she could have copyrighted it. She could have done really well. That's fantastic on that. And whether she'd have had to sue the person who Mary had a little lamb, which comes along later, whether there'd have been copyright action there, I don't know. That's because the names are quite interesting in nursery rhymes. Jill tends to represent every woman, and Jack tends to represent every man, particularly if he's a bit dodgy, particularly if he's a bit shady. You get this name Jack coming up all the time. And obviously, the end of the 19th century, you have Jack the Ripper. You could not have had Brian the Ripper. It wouldn't have worked in the same way. This seems to be a semiotics is the wrong word, but there seems to be name associations, and Jack and Jill are the most popular throughout nursery rhymes, with Mary, I'd say, running about third on this particular one. But Mary had the brains to branch out, obviously.
The time is up.
I'm sorry.
I am too. It's been a delight talking with you this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Chris Roberts has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, Heavy Words Lightly Thrown, The Reason Behind the Rhyme. The book's available in the U.S. from Gotham Books, and you can find Chris Roberts online at fmpublications.co.uk. That interview with Chris Roberts conducted on October 10th of this year. It's 1:52 Central Time. Up next, settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Here now with the highs, lows, and settlements from the Chicago Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Then maybe we'll better do a quick update of the winter storm warning that is in effect for this afternoon, too. Celeste will do that now. Ed Kieser tells us that a winter storm warning in effect for LaPorte, St. Joseph, Elkhart, Marshall, and Kosciuszko counties in northern Indiana. That finished up about 1 o'clock this afternoon. So if you're in those areas, those snow storms probably are causing some problems. That is all completed. But just to make sure that you are aware that if you're traveling to those areas, likely to be some heavy snow as we go through the afternoon. Now, the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade today. The wheat futures settled unchanged in the December contract at 297, settlement price a high at 299, a low at 96.5, and a settlement price once again at $2.97 for the December wheat. It finished the day unchanged. March contract a 315 high, the low there at 312.25, settlement price at 312.75. They were unchanged. And May futures down a quarter, 321.5. The final price for the day, that was also low. The high price for the May wheat at 323.5 on this day's trade. July futures a 332.5 high, low at 329. Settlement price at 330.75. They were unchanged. And September futures in the wheat pit, 340.5. The high, the low at 338. September futures from the Chicago Board of Trade for the soft red winter wheat settled at $3.39. They were down a quarter. By the way, the trade finished up at noon today, ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday tomorrow, and then trade will resume on Friday of this week for a full day of trade. Although Dave Dickey and I will not be here to bring those numbers to you. We've decided to spend that day with our Thanksgiving, with our families instead. Let's go on to the futures in the corn pit now. December contract, 191.75, the high. The low at $1.90.5, a settlement price at 190.75. They were down 3/4. March futures, 205.25, the high. Low at 204, settlement price at 204.25. They were off a penny for the day. May futures in the corn pit, 213.5 high, low at 212, settlement price 212.5, off 1 cent. And July futures, 221.25 the high, the low at 220, settlement price 220.25. They were down 1. September's 230.25 the high, the low at 229. And a settlement price for the September corn at 229.25, off a penny for the day. December futures, 241 the high, the low at 240, settlement price at $2.40.25. They were off 3/4. December oats, 178.25 the high. The low there at 175.75, settlement price at 176 for the Dease oats. They were up 1/4. The March contract down 3/4. The high at 85, the low at 80.25, and a settlement price at $1.81.5 for the March oats, down 0.75 on this Wednesday afternoon. January soybeans now 571.25, the high, the low at 561, settlement price at 562. They were off 10.25 today. March futures were off 11.25, 579.5, the high, the low at 67. Settlement price at 568.75. And May soybeans were down 9.75, 576.5, the final trade for the day. The high at 85, the low at 76. July futures, 589.5, the high, the low at 581.5. A settlement price at 582.25, down 9 cents. August futures, 589.75, the high, the low at 85. Settlement price at 85, down 8.5 cents. And September contract, $5.93 the high, the low at $5.85, and a settlement there at $5.85 on the low, down 7 cents for the soybeans. Next year's November contract for the harvest month, $5.95.5 the high, the low at $89.25. A settlement price at $5.90 even. They were down 6.75. Rest of the soy complex, the products, bean meal, $173.40 the high, the low at $170.50. Settlement price at $170.70 off $2.90. January meal, $174.50 the high, the low at $171.70. Settlement price at $171.80 down $3.10. December bean oil, $21.92 the high, the low at $21.57. Settlement price at $21.63. They were off $35. And January bean oil, $22.07 the high, the low at $21.73. Settlement price at $22.82, down $31. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Livestock contracts finished higher again today. They were up yesterday as well. January feeder cattle, the high $114.55, the low $113.75, the settlement $114.40, then up $122.50. March, $112.80, the high, $111.70, the low, $112.77.5, the settlement, that up $125. April, $111.20, the high, $110.65, the low, $111.10, the settlement, that up $90. December, live cattle, $92.15, the high, $91.45, the low, finishing at $91.95, that up $92.50. February, $94.60, the high, $93.75, the low, $94.30, the settlement, that up $80. December, lean hog, $62.20, the high, the low, $61.40, the settlement, $61.85, that up $52.50. February, $66.35, the high, $65.40, the low, $65.65, the settlement, then up $27.50. April, lean hog, $68.20, the high, $67.40, the low, the settlement, $67.70, up $37.50. May, lean hog, $69.65, the high, the low, $68.70, the settlement, $69.65, then up $92.50. February, pork bellies, $88.70, the high, the low, $86.60, the settlement $88.15, that finishing down $7.50. That was the loan contract that we keep track of that finished lower on the day today on the Merc. The Dow is up 67 points at 10,939. The NASDAQ 11 higher at 2265. The S&P 500 is up 7 points at 1269.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn. Henry Frayne is our technical director this afternoon. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. It's 54 degrees on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Winter storm warning is posted for LaPorte, St. Joe.